All right. Good morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's news from the Drug War Front. My name is Jeff, and my co-presenter is Marion. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, listeners, and happy spring.
Isn't it lovely to see the sun?
Beautiful. Haven't the last few days been lovely?
It's a real spirit lifter,
yeah.
I must admit.
It makes me feel much better about being here.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm all for spring. All right, welcome listeners to News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy, which is Canberra's peer-based drug user organisation. Now, the aim of the show is hopefully to inform and also educate listeners about the failure of the war on drugs, or to describe it somewhat more accurately, the war on people who use drugs. And aside from that debate and discussion, we also promote the services provided and offered by CARMA and also other agencies in the alcohol and other drug sector in the Australian Capital Territory. The contents of this News from the Drug War Front broadcast do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy, CARMA. CARMA does not condone nor condemn drug use and does not promote illegal activity. CARMA recognises that drug use happens, and as such, CARMA focuses on harm reduction messages, drug treatment support services, advocacy and community development. CARMA seeks to reduce the harms associated with drug use as well as the harms associated with the criminalisation of drug use through the provision of empowering programs that concentrate on community development, person-centred holistic healthcare, and also equity of health service delivery for all people. Do you want to tell listeners a little bit about what CARMA actually does?
I do.
Day-to-day?
Okay, so the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy is Canberra's only peer-based drug user group. CARMA provides a wide range of services, including client advocacy, as Jeff said, peer treatment support, education, representation, information, creative arts, mentoring, and referrals, and of course, yours truly on the radio show. The CARMA office is located in the Church's Centre at Level 1, Shop 17, 54 Benjamin Way in Belconnen. So if you're on a rapid bus from Civic to Belconnen, get off at the community bus stop, cross the road, and you'll see a white building that's the Church's Centre. That's it. CARMA's office hours are from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday to Friday. Now, CARMA developed and ran the first trial of a peer naloxone, that's Narcan, program ever in Australia, and that's important and really relevant at the moment because, you know, as if you've read in the paper or listened to the TV at all, you'll know that we've had at least one person die every fortnight from an overdose from illicit opiate use. So knowing how to use naloxone is really important. After a positive evaluation of the program with 200 opioid users in Canberra, new funding was granted and CARMA continues the education of opioid users at regular opioid overdose recognition and response with naloxone workshops, and also with brief interventions with individual clients. That's where Dave or his sidekick will go out to a house, stand on the doorstep, introduce people to naloxone, give them the sniff up the nose one, and then just spend 10 minutes telling people how to use it, how to recognise an opioid overdose, and how to use the nasal spray. Workers at other ACT, alcohol and other drug agencies are also receiving training. CARMA can also assist with issues related to opioid maintenance treatment, that's methadone or buprenorphine, the availability of detox and rehab services in the ACT, the impact of stigma and discrimination, and problems getting access to proper pain relief, which is a biggie. Mm-hmm. In fact, all issues faced by people impacted by prohibition and the war on people who use drugs.
Indeed. All right, let's go to a song and then we'll get into the first women's story.
Yeah, we've got a story this week from the Support Don't Punish project that was CARMA was funded to do from the International Network of Women Who Use Drugs. Yeah.
Okay, I've picked an Eminem song. It's featuring Beyonce and it's Walk on Water. Eminem. All right, that was Eminem and Walk on Water featuring Beyonce. He's some rapper, Eminem, and Beyonce, boy, what a voice. She can
absolutely
really sing.
Absolutely, yep.
That's a shout-out to Damo, that one Eminem probably one of his greatest
fans.
That's
right. You went down to the concert, didn't you, with him?
Saw him at the MCG, and he was incredible, absolutely amazing. Okay, it's about 19 minutes to 11. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front with Jeff and Marion in the 2XX studio, of course, Canberra's Community Radio. And as Marion mentioned just before the song, we've actually got a story from the 2020 Support Don't Punish campaign. We were funded by the Women's Harm Reduction International Network to
get
stories.
Right.
And we have a new story. And Marion, over to you.
Okay, thank you. So this is from Alice. I'll just get right into it. My history of using is long and complex. First, I did use and had a bad habit. This ended with the birth of my first child. The birth was horrible. I was treated like a leper. I was separated from, quote, the real mothers, accused of using heroin while I was in hospital, and separated from my son and from the other mothers, I might add, because I was on methadone, a high dose. After my boy's birth, I was suddenly receiving all of that methadone, and I looked stoned. Instead of reducing my methadone because the staff didn't know how to manage me, they stopped me from seeing him and took him to foster care while I was withdrawn over a six-week period. I was taken to a new rehab in town run by nice kids, my own age, who taught me that there were kind people in the world and that natural therapies like massage, self-hypnosis, bark flower remedies and kindness could play a big part in getting straight again. Not clipping grass with nail scissors for punishment, 12-step programs, abstinence from everything and strict routine applied by cured addicts as long as they didn't use anything. Ever. After 6 months of foster care, my son came back to me. For a further 3 months, he and I lived in a halfway house. Not using, just getting used to each other. I found that I still had a brain that worked and started and completed a degree in applied science at University of Canberra. I discovered that time, I loved that time. My son went to creche, I made new friends, lived in a group house, and discovered that although emotionally I fluctuated wildly, life was fun. People were generally good if you let them be. And if you chose to be offended, hurt, happy, sad, excited, rather than thought that people made you that way, you were in control of your life and loves and the system. If you didn't bring yourself into its attention, generally, it left you live without interference. After my degree, I worked largely in the NGO's welfare sector, ending up with the Drug and Alcohol Agency Development. When funding was being introduced for innovative programs, I had plenty of ideas. How to empower people, how to create novel treatment projects, how to connect with current drug users and use their peers to educate them, especially to stop HIV/AIDS transmission, how to manipulate the system and make use of the access to power, that is, influence, that being in Canberra allows. So creating novel services to support, educate, reduce HIV transmission, reduce imprisonment rates and alleviate intervention, domestic violence protection and so on. It was exciting and created internationally recognised programs and projects that are still valid and useful today. The Needle Exchange Program, for instance, peer education and programs for current drug users, the use of natural therapies in drug withdrawal, liaising with courts and police to reduce the extent to which the judicial system crushed drug users. Changing the drug laws? Well, not so much. And while trying to make it clear that prohibition just creates criminals, it doesn't decrease or increase the prevalence of addiction. Plenty of people agreed, but that doesn't change laws. You've got to get them repealed. Baby number two came along 3 years into my employment after university and 8 years after stopping my illicit drug use, mostly. I found that a few puffs on a marijuana joint stopped my morning sickness. Apart from that, I didn't use or drink much. The difference in treatment by hospital staff of me as a non-drug-using mum was huge. The only discrimination I faced was from my obstetrician. I had foolishly told him that I was on methadone for my first child. I was horrified when he wrote it on my file and insisted that he deleted it. Wow, he did. Can I tell you my big lesson from all of this? Don't tell people your history, but use it as lessons learned. People do not know what you did 8 years ago. If you don't do it now, it doesn't matter. Discrimination still rankles with me, and lots of people will use your disclosures to their benefit. Who I am now is what matters. My children have both grown into terrific men, and I'm proud of them. I'm using again, but I had a long period where I didn't, and I'm proud of that. I did some good things. Right now, and after a long time, and for a long time I have believed this, the law should be changed. We've gone backwards, and the impact of the laws on people who have chronic pain issues, myself included, are extremely detrimental. I will fight for those who need pain relief. Drugs don't kill people. Ignorance does. If you know what you are taking and how much of it you need to give the required effect, and you have access to it, you should be okay. Keeping people ignorant only promotes guilt and guilty behavior. Remember, just because you use illicit drugs doesn't make you a bad person. Most people support their drug use legally. Some drugs are not good for you. Some combinations are downright deadly. If pill testing is available, use it. If it isn't, then be careful. You can always use more, but you can't use less. Drug use is personal. If your doctor is prescribing for you, follow the directions. Find out as much as you can about the intended effects, side effects, what drugs should be taken together. Some drugs enhance or exaggerate the effects of others, like alcohol and heroin. Some drugs change the effects of others, like alcohol and antibiotics. Alcohol is a drug. If you don't like yourself when you take drugs, odds are no one else does either. Think about it. If you know heroin users, or even if you don't think you do, learn how to use naloxone or Narcan. Safe sex is the best kind if you're still having some. Learn how to use... Oops. Talk about things that you are happy, sad, angry, or frustrated about. Drugs exaggerate or enhance your feelings, but they don't go away, the feelings, that is. Wonderful people exist. Become one. Magic happens. Look for it. Help people, but look after you first. If you are empty, you have nothing to give. I'm old. Don't put me in a nursing home.
Wow, what a wonderful story. Very
good
pieces of advice. I think the one about being very careful about disclosing and thinking the confidentiality will be maintained.
I thought that was a good point, absolutely, because people will hold it against you. And you don't know where it's going to come from, Jeffrey. You know, it might pop up in a meeting when, you know, when you're not that person, not the same person that you were all those years ago. Yeah. So thank you, Alice, for that. It's not, and any women who have stories, just get in touch with someone at Karma. You can do it over the phone. You can write it down for yourself, or you can put it onto a computer and send the stick into Karma. But get in touch with someone at Karma. The Support Don't Punish campaign, despite the fact that it was really only going for a month, is still accepting contributions of stories from women and their interaction with the healthcare system as drug users. So please do that. It's a, you know, you're get paid for your contribution, and whether that matters to you or not, some people it's really important for. But we'd love to hear from you.
And I think we've had some extraordinary
We've had some stories. Fabulous stories, So, and I'd like to thank Natasha too for her help on doing this project, and Jeffrey, you too, because you've been contributing. And that's not bad for a man. You're doing pretty damn good.
Thank you, Mary. But yes, we've still got the capacity to pay for some more stories.
And we're still accepting stories. And although it's difficult, if you can write it down, so much the better. And we will read it out over the radio show pretty soon after it's been put down on paper.
Absolutely.
So we'd love to hear from you.
All right. You picked this song, Marion, by Sheryl Crow.
Yeah, if it makes you happy. I was just thinking it's spring. We need a little bit of uppityness, yeah?
All right, Sheryl Crow. All right, that was Sheryl Crow. And if it makes you happy, it's five minutes to 11, and you're listening to News from the Drug War Front on 2XX.
With Jeff and Marion.
With Jeff and Marion, 98.3 FM. Okay, just a couple of things that Karma's doing. Today at Windeyer Court in Watson, which that's a public house in the state.
That's right, just opposite the Watson shops, yep.
They're going to be out there at noon today with access to naloxone, fentanyl test strips, and some lunch will be provided.
Oh, so good. That'll bring people down. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the one last week, I think I said it the wrong venue.
Was actually you said Kananga, and it was at Condamine Court. Yeah.
But people were really pleased to see.
Normally, they can smell the barbecue, Jeffrey, and they'll go down everywhere, particularly at the public.
This was
flats
just sandwiches.
Complexes.
There wasn't even the smell of barbecue.
It wasn't a smell of barbecue. No. Okay, singers.
But the word got out and people were very pleased.
Excellent.
To,
oh, that's good. I'm pleased to hear it.
And you've heard some developments at the NSP?
Yes. I've been promising you for ages. Well, if I haven't promised you out loud, I've been promising you in my head that I would tell you when the Needle Exchange Program outreach bus would be available. And I just got told by Mickey this morning that it will be at Kananga Court on Tuesdays from about 10 till 12, and on Friday it will be at Oaks Estate from 10 to 12. So this is in the mornings, not in the evenings, gang. So Tuesday at Kananga Court and Friday at Oaks Estate, both from 10 till 12. And it's just something that you should make yourselves available, avail yourselves of, because you don't need to reuse needles and syringes, and safe drug use is safe needle use. I'm afraid you just no way around it. So not only that, but you can get plenty of information from them too, and access to other services. So, avail yourselves.
And gets neglected a lot, so it's good they're going out there.
Yeah, it is good, yeah.
All right, we're going to just read a media release that came out actually for yesterday, which was International Overdose Awareness Day, and it's headed Calls for Greater Focus on Prevention and Harm. The Australian Injecting and Illicit Drug Users League, or AIBL, is calling for a greater focus on key prevention and harm reduction initiatives on International Overdose Awareness Day today, which was yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah.
In particular, AIBL is calling for the implementation of widespread peer distribution of the opioid overdose reversal drug naloxone and enhanced resourcing for peer-based overdose prevention programs across the country. And this is next in quotes. The National Drug Strategy refers specifically to the need to prevent and respond to overdose, including increased access to naloxone. Mm-hmm. On International Overdose Awareness Day, the focus is on those initiatives that prevent overdoses and save lives. In the context of rising rates of overdose across the country, there really needs to be an enhanced focus on the implementation of evidence-based prevention and harm reduction measures, said Melanie Walker, CEO of AIBL. Australia's annual overdose report 2020, which was released yesterday by the Pennington Institute, has revealed that for the fifth year running, more than 2,000 Australians lost their lives to overdose in a single calendar year in 2018. Now, most of these deaths were accidental. This new report reinforces previous research by the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, or NDARC, showing that heroin is now once again the leading opioid underlying opioid-induced accidental deaths. There have been increases in deaths involving synthetic opioids, such as fentanyl and tramadol, over the past decade. An increasing rate of deaths involving psychotropic medicines, for example, benzodiazepines and antipsychotics, and also non-opioid medicines used for the treatment of certain pain conditions, such as pregabalin, remains of concern. It is important to note that these medicines are often identified alongside other drugs. For example, cases where opioids are the underlying cause of deaths and benzodiazepines are an associated cause of death.
Yeah, so the combination of drugs. Each year, still with this quote, each year the national road toll is consistently exceeded by the number of Australians losing their lives to accidental drug overdose. International Overdose Awareness Day is a global event held on the 31st of August each year, aiming to raise the awareness of overdose and reduce the stigma of drug-related deaths. It acknowledges the grief felt by families and friends remembering those who have met with death or permanent injury as a result of drug overdose. As part of International Overdose Awareness Day, AIBL's member organisations around the country will be undertaking activities to promote the awareness and prevention and remember those lost. A key message is that the tragedy of overdose deaths is preventable. In this context, it's important to focus on practical things that can be done right now in Australia to save lives. People whose drugs have an important role People who use drugs have an important role to play as part of the broader prevention and harm reduction efforts. Enabling greater access to naloxone and peer-based overdose prevention programs are practical ways that governments can help people protect themselves and prevent overdose deaths, which would be a wonderful outcome for individuals, families and the broader community, said Ms. Walker. ABLE's a national organisation representing people who use or have used illicit drugs, and it's basically the government says there's a whole stack of stuff that we can do, so really the government needs to step up and do it.
And invest more in all the services that are lacking. Yes. Anyway, I think we're going to a national story. This is sort of relates to...
Well, absolutely. It's quite... related. I mean, there was a story in the Canberra Times too, Geoffrey, that opioid overdose deaths are one a fortnight in Canberra over the last 12 months, there's been, which means there's been, you know, 26 at least in the last 12 months. That's 26 too many as far as I'm concerned and as far as you are too, I imagine.
All right, this piece is from The Conversation. Opioids continue to be the leading cause of overdose deaths in Australia. What else can we do? By Amanda Roxburgh, Paul Dietz and Suzanne Nielsen, August 31st. In 2018, more than 2,000 people died from drug overdoses in Australia, about five every day. That's according to the Pennington Institute's annual overdose report released today, obviously yesterday.
Yep.
The largest number of overdose deaths, more than 1,000, involved opioids, for example, heroin, morphine, oxycodone, fentanyl, followed by benzodiazepines, such as Valium. Opioid-related deaths in Australia have been on an upward trend in recent years, having doubled since 2006. This means that we're now not far off numbers recorded in the late 1990s, when opioid-related deaths were at their highest. There's much more that we could be doing to curb this problem. And there's a subheading, what kind of opioids are causing harm? Unlike in North America, where illicitly manufactured fentanyl has been involved in many opioid deaths, most opioid deaths in Australia involve pharmaceutical opioids. That said, heroin deaths have increased over the past 5 years. Among all opioid deaths, just over half of people overdosing have a history of injecting drugs and substance use issues. We know people with chronic non-cancer pain are becoming dependent on pharmaceutical opioids and are now also among these statistics. Some 80% of opioid deaths are accidental. While 16% are deemed intentional overdose, the remaining 4% we don't know. Intentional overdoses are twice as common with pharmaceutical opioids.
The current strategies. A large driver of increasing opioid deaths internationally has been the increase in prescribing and use of pharmaceutical opioids. Australia ranks 10th worldwide. Australia has introduced a range of strategies to manage and restrict supply, including rescheduling codeine prescription only, introducing smaller pack sizes and setting up systems to track prescribing. As many of these changes have only recently been implemented, it's too early to know whether or not they're having a positive effect. Well, frankly, this report says that what's happened is that most people are using illicit. And that's what they're dying from, certainly in the ACT, they're dying from illicit use, drug use. So we can tell you that right now, and that's from the report as well. But regulatory responses run the risk of unintended consequences. We saw this in Australia with the reformulation of oxycodone tablets to a product that's more difficult to inject. Heroin-related ambulance call-outs and emergency department presentations increased significantly in Victoria after this change was introduced. In North America, restricted opioid prescribing was associated with dramatic increases in heroin and illicitly manufactured fentanyl deaths. One key response to opioid overdose has been providing opioid agonist treatment, for example, methadone or buprenorphine. To opioid-dependent people, typically those with a history of injecting drugs. Well, only really. It's the people with dependencies that they will provide that for. But only around half take up this treatment, and Australians with pharmaceutical opioid dependence are unlikely to seek this type of help. You might ask why, Geoffrey. I think we're at the end of that statement. Barriers to treatment include critical shortages of prescribers, in brackets addiction to medicine specialists and trained GPs, stigma and the requirement to attend a clinic or pharmacy daily at the start of treatment. We need to double treatment capacity to meet the demand for people who may benefit from opioid agonist treatment.
Which is what we said before, there needs to be a greater investment in a whole lot of harm reduction services.
Just keep investing in a wider variety of services, yes.
And more options.
And more of them, yeah.
Okay, the next subheading is what else can we do? Well, we can make opioid use safer. The two supervised injecting facilities in Australia play a very important role in reducing public injecting and responding to overdoses on site. Neither service, the one in Sydney and the one in Melbourne, has had a single death since opening. The Victorian government has approved a second Melbourne facility and a study. Yeah, the second one is opening up.
Good on them.
And a study is currently underway in looking at whether a facility would be useful in Canberra. And Karma was part of the surveys to get input into what sort of facility or drug consumption room would be most effective, whether it would be not just one big central one, but a couple spread around.
How does that go with the COVID restrictions, Dylan? The one in Richmond, do you know? Because they're not allowed, people are not allowed to go out with the schedule, with the, what is it, the four, level four restrictions. They're only allowed out for an hour and they've got to go within a certain limit, with certain distance from home.
I'd have to check that out.
And just an interesting question. They might make acceptance for injectors so that they don't die, yeah?
It said, establishing these facilities does require a lot of planning, as well as changes to legislation. And scaling them up to reach more Australians who inject drugs has proven difficult. There has been no movement on calls made several years ago to set up a second medically supervised injection
centre. Not going to happen with Berejiklian, and I suspect.
Seems unlikely, yep. But we know these services do save lives and help get people into treatment, so we need to keep scaling them up. In the past 3 years, Canada has opened 24 new supervised injecting
24,
facilities.
24, Gladys, 24.
While Australia has opened only one, we also need to consider innovations to ensure safer opioid supply. In Europe and North America, drug researchers monitor the heroin supply for dangerous contaminants, and we've seen early work like this in Australia, including at Sydney's Safe Injecting Centre. These monitoring services provide critical information on opioid supply and can help people using opioids to make better informed decisions.
What about the pandemic? Yeah, this is my point exactly. We don't yet know how COVID-19 will affect opioid deaths in Australia. We'll need to continually monitor how the pandemic affects access to treatment for opioid dependence and any disruptions to opioid supply. But one thing is clear, the pandemic has shown we can respond quickly to implement change. Treatment services have rapidly adapted to COVID-19 restrictions, for example, by making it possible for people to receive methadone and buprenorphine without having to visit a clinic or pharmacy every day. And remember, Jeffrey, Chris was in and gave us, they had protocols set up very early on in the piece on how to make methadone and buprenorphine available to people who were COVID positive. So I think the ACT responded to that quite quickly. I'm very proud of them for that. As well as making treatment more flexible, the pandemic has addressed broader needs for some people who are dependent on opioids, such as providing temporary accommodation. Hopefully, these changes will provide longer-term benefits, including encouraging people to remain in treatment. In addressing opioid overdose deaths in Australia, we need to follow the basic best evidence, extending our vision to responses implemented internationally and evaluate them locally. Importantly, responses should be formulated within the frame of good clinical care rather than relying on punitive responses such as mandatory drug testing for welfare recipients. That's just a ludicrous suggestion. This creates further problems such as stigma for people who use drugs.
Yeah, I think that's quite a sound piece.
Yeah, very useful,
There's three authors, Amanda Roxburgh, who's a research fellow at the National Health Medical Research Centre, and also Burnett Institute, Paul Dietz, Head of Alcohol and Other Drug Research at the Centre for Population Health, a Burnett Principal for Alcohol, Other Drugs and Harm Reduction, and Suzanne Nielsen, Associate Professor and Deputy Director, Monash Addiction Research Centre, Monash Uni, Clayton in Melbourne.
There are some comments. Do we want to read those, Jeffrey?
Yeah, might as well.
One by Cormac. Oh, that's an interesting name. Osiochain, okay. Astounded that there is no mention of cannabis here. It's an incredibly effective alternative to opioids, and countries, states that have legalised it report huge improvements around opioid abuse a use death. A comment by Stephen Davis in reply to Cormac goes, you only did that so that I'd have trouble pronouncing it.
It's an Irish name, I've got no idea.
Yes, quite clearly. Perhaps part of the problem is roadside drug tests that you see being found guilty if even a trace of THC is found in your blood long after the effects have worn off. Yeah,
that's good, a good
response,
point.
Stephen. Yeah.
Another comment by Jock Webb. Looks like taking away my Panadine, the only painkiller that ever helped me, didn't help much. Does this increase indicate a serious mental health issue in Australia, I wonder? And also comment by Amanda Roxburgh in reply, you raise an interesting issue in relation to codeine, Jock. We need to look further into the data to see if there have been impacts of the rescheduling on codeine-related deaths, and that's something we're working on. And you're absolutely right. Comorbid mental health issues are prevalent among people both with chronic pain and substance use issues.
Yeah, boom, boom. Like, we haven't been saying that for very long, but really, Amanda, it is great to bring it up in that context. I'm surprised that it's not in the report. Anyway, nonetheless, I think that's important stuff and a good article.
Indeed.
We want to go to another song?
Yeah, I thought, and we played this only a couple of weeks ago, but Peter Tosh's Legalise It seems.
Why not? Seems appropriate,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Peter Tosh. All right, that was Peter Tosh and the title track from the album Legalise It. It's about 16 minutes after 11 and you're on 2XX Canberra's Community Radio, People Powered Radio. And just while on the subject of 2XX, if you do like our show or any of the other 60-odd original shows that are made by volunteers each and every week here in the ACT, do seriously consider becoming a paid-up member of 2XX. It's a sliding scale of fees, depending on whether you're working full-time, part-time, or not working at all. And it's a good way of supporting a very important voice for organisations and communities that don't get a voice in mainstream media. So give it a serious consideration. On the international scene, I'd really like to strongly recommend anyone who hasn't had a chance to see any of what will be a 10-part series of documentaries on the history of the movement of people who use drugs. It's called Taking Back What's Ours. And in collaboration with the Rights Reporter Foundations, also known as Drug Reporter, the International Network of People Who Use Drugs, INPWD, is excited to share the series Taking Back What's Ours, a new documentary film series which captures the history and the genesis of the global movement of people who use drugs. In this series, you will meet activists who are undertaking critical work in their communities, and you will learn how they navigate this work within the context of criminalisation, stigmatisation and oppression. And special thanks go to INPWD board member Tony Van Montfort for driving this project and all the other outstanding activists featured in this series who are fighting for the rights of people who use drugs all over the world. I've just started watching episode 8 of the 10-part series, and it focuses on Afghanistan, Tanzania and Mexico. And I've only watched the section on Afghanistan. And at times when you think things are difficult for illicit drug users in a first world country like Australia, when you see the plight of injecting drug users in Afghanistan and cities like Kabul, it's a whole nother world. It's pretty hard to watch, actually, to be honest with you. But this episode also covers Tanzania and Mexico. So it takes us to three different regions to examine familiar themes on the subject of drug user organising. In Afghanistan, Abdur Rahim Rajaev from the Bridge Hope Health Organisation shows how his organisation is distributing syringes to people who use drugs under extremely harsh and neglectful conditions.
That sounds dreadful, Jeffrey, doesn't it?
Well, there's a section, Marion, where they're showing, like, a lot of the drug users just injecting the street or under the bridges. They're very much forgotten.
Exposed
and neglected.
Yeah.
But one fellow was saying that often public health won't even come and pick up people
bodies.
Have died,
yeah.
So they're just rot in the street, which is...
It's horrible.
Pretty unpleasant. And I also thought, you know, Muslims are meant to be buried fairly quickly after you die, washed and buried. And a lot of them are saying their families don't have anywhere to even come and grieve or pay their respects. You know,
and it's just because they're using drugs doesn't mean they're not Muslims. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't mean they've forsaken their religion. I'm just horrified with just the whole idea of it. The beauty of Input's performance, though. I'm so pleased that they're doing this, Geoffrey. It's just, we've been talking about this off air for a while. It's so good to see the comparison of circumstances. I guess big plays that we're not in a bad situation like Afghanistan, but really, what would you do with dope that good? You know, obviously once you've used once, you'd be going, whoa.
Well, the key is cheaper to buy than it is to buy one syringe. One of the
a dollar,
people
you
in
said,
the documentary.
Yeah.
US,
dollar US.
One US dollar,
yeah,
for one syringe.
Which is out of reach for them. You know, once they've got their drugs, they can't afford to buy a clean syringe.
It's pretty hard watching.
Horrendous.
And in episode 8, it also goes to Tanzania and Happier San from the Tanzanian Network of People Who Use Drugs, or TANPUD. She talks about her country's amending of a drug bill in 2015 that worked to lessen penalties for drug offences in Tanzania. So that's good work in that part of Africa. And in Mexico, Bruno Gonzalez from the Latin American Network of People Who Use Drugs, or LANPUD, discusses some of the major barriers for drug user organising, including the false equivalency of people, this is by the government, false equivalency of people who use drugs with narco culture.
Yeah, they're not the same people. The ones who use are not the ones that are making the fortune or exchanging the drugs for guns. You're not just... That's not them.
And the level of violence that the cartels inflict just on anyone who gets in their way. And Bruno also talks about other forms of religious and cultural stigma in his country, Mexico. So I really strongly recommend that if you haven't seen any of these, the first one started off in Holland and Belgium.
Yep.
Episode 6 was Australia, New Zealand. Episode 8, as I say, is Afghanistan, Tanzania and Mexico. And I think episode 9 will be... actually, I'm not sure episode 9, but there's two more to come anyway.
Yeah.
So I think
Russia. Must have been exciting, but also kind of frightening to be doing these, to be going to the different countries and interviewing the people, getting all this oral history. Can you imagine? Well, Geoffrey, you've done more of it than I have, going to different countries and meeting the people who are actually involved in doing either NSP or peer education or. You know, it just would be so exciting, but also, as I say, frightening to do that.
And you meet some wonderful people, like the
Absolutely.
Majority of people involved in the global drug user movement are some of the most wonderful, intelligent, you know.
Well, and not only despite what they're doing, but because of what they're doing in their own lives, that they are contributing, giving back to their community. And I just am so proud of them. For that, it's just, you know, and I feel, you know, like first of spring, all my heart is just boom, 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 you know, throbbing just to think of it.
Yep. Well, to watch them, you can just tap in Input, INPED, into a search engine and it will come up and you'll find it.
I'm so pleased with their output, Geoffrey. I'm proud of Input too for doing all this. Really makes me feel good about. And there's been such a lot of positive stuff coming out over the past few weeks. And I suspect it's because everything else is closed down. I was just thinking about this while I was downstairs. Everything else is closed down. Nothing else to talk about. Let's talk about drugs. You know, because that's what's come up, yeah? And nobody's doing anything else. Nobody stops taking drugs. Isn't that interesting?
Very interesting.
Also don't stop domestic violence, I might add.
On the downside.
So they still beat up their women, but they also use their drugs. And, you know, people don't stop doing the personal, intimate stuff just because of a virus.
Yeah.
Hepatitis showed that, HIV showed that, COVID showing that too.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the coppers are still squashing them. It's just us squashing us. What's the point, guys? You know, you need us to come to the surface and be part of the community. We can't do that if you're discriminating us and pushing us down again. If every time we pop... Remember there was a joke, Geoffrey, you know, in the trenches in World War II. They'd say, hands, yeah, bang. So every time they popped their head up, they got blown off by the... That was a joke in the First and Second World War. So they do... And that's not a joke for us. That's what happens. Every time we put our head up... out of the trenches, bang, we get
criminalized,
discriminated against,
is not
punished, chased, you name it.
Fix anything.
My
play song, this is probably the best song I've ever heard about crystal methamphetamine. It's by Mark Lanigan and it's Methamphetamine Blues.
I'm eating them all.
Okay, that was Mark Lanegan Band, and the album is Bubblegum, and the track was Methamphetamine Blues.
Sounds like Methamphetamine Blues too, doesn't it, Jeffrey? All jangly and...
It's a brilliant track, it really is, yeah. And shout out to Jason for putting me onto that band. It's a cracking song.
Mm.
Okay, we're going to do a piece. We don't often do stories from South Africa,
no.
But we have one today called Enemies of the Nation, How the War on Drugs Has Totally Failed South Africa.
Yeah, this is by Edwin Cameron of the dailymaverick.com.za. That's what, Zambia, August the 19th. Drug use is a social and health issue. It's not a criminal justice issue, and it certainly is not a national security issue. There is no health rationale for invoking criminal law sanctions. The global war on drugs has failed. The decades during which it has been waged have inflicted devastating consequences on societies in both hemispheres. These are no longer fringe advocacy assertions. They are an increasingly obvious truth. A series of authoritative international reports has documented the calamitous mistakes and catastrophic impact of warring on drug use and drug users. There's a much better way to deal with drug use and dependency. Mounting evidence indicates that these are best addressed as social and public health issues and not as crimes. Our own former Zambian president, Kgalema Motlanthe, has added his name to call for reason. Recently, he joined the Global Commission on Drug Policy in condemning the misplaced strategy of, quote, the war on drugs. In 2018, the United Nations, the UN, finally conceded that its policies had failed to eliminate drug use. So that's 2 years ago now, Jeffrey. It's a long time for it to be standing. Instead, they spawned monster offshoots. The harms include a multi-billion dollar black market in drugs and the catastrophic weakening of justice and financial systems and political structures. These result from massive amounts of drug money that bend politicians, lawyers, prosecutors, jailers, even judges, and, of course, always, banks. In addition, treating drug users as criminals denies them counselling, information, education, and medical help and support. In the wake of the UN's turnabout, UN chief executives representing 31 UN agencies in March 2019 expressed, quote, strong and unanimous support, end quote, for decriminalising possession and use of drugs. Recently, South Africa took a small but significant step vindicating this approach. In September 2018, the Constitutional Court's Prince judgment, to which I was party, struck down criminal laws preventing the use and possession of small amounts of cannabis for personal consumption in private. How did the world come to blunder so badly on drugs? Quote, war, end quote, talk, futile, brash, misplaced macho speak, has been with us since President Richard Nixon declared drug abuse public enemy number one. The notion that drug use and distribution can be stopped by macho talk and guns has proved catastrophically wrong.
Yeah, it goes on to say, but who are the enemies against whom we are warring with in this militarised campaign of policing, criminal law and incarceration? They're not alien invaders, but our own people. Mm. Locally, drug war rhetoric still dominates. Communities with high levels of drug use are, quote, war zones. Drug use is wrongly conflated with gangsterism. And drug trafficking, quote, and its associated challenges, are described as a threat that, quote, undermines our national safety and security. But who are the enemies? Oh, that's a repeat of the same quote, yeah.
Yeah.
More importantly, what has this war achieved? Globally, every year, perhaps $100 billion is spilt down the drain of drug-related law enforcement, an estimated $50 billion by the United States alone. Millions of people are arrested for what are non-violent drug-related offences. Many people who use drugs and subsistence sellers receive extremely harsh sentences. And there's also a class dimension to all of this. Santon or Constantia cocaine users inside their gated communities are seldom, if ever, targeted by police, nor are the kingpins who profit from artificial margins that only prohibition and a black market can create. Enough to buy allies in law enforcement and at the borders who ensure a ready and continuing supply. It is the drug mules, the small-scale subsistence sellers, the small-time suppliers who are sacrificed to police action to make it seem that there is effective action or to strike a blow against the competition. In South Africa, minimum sentences criminalising drugs and other drugs have long scarred our courts and police and the administration of justice. The apartheid ideologue, Dr. Connie Mulder, introduced these measures back in 1971. They continue to burden criminal trial court roles and exacerbate prison overcrowding. The current statutory provisions stipulate the same minimum sentences, 15 years for non-violent drug trafficking, as for certain categories of murder. So you basically do the same amount of time for taking a life as...
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is in Australia, Jeffrey. You know, I did, 2 years, which was drug-related crime. The woman that murdered her boyfriend did 2 months less than me.
Doesn't seem right.
Unsentenced, yeah.
Wow.
What's wrong?
It goes on to say, this reveals shockingly how badly wrong both our theory and our practice of drug use have gone in trying to curb it. Overuse of incarceration has led to choked full prisons as well as inhumane and degrading conditions of detention. Paradoxically, these produce an environment for gangs and drug use to flourish.
Mm.
There is no doubt that drug use can be a problem and can lead to devastating consequences that must be countered. It can spawn social ills, just like cigarette smoking and alcohol use. All three are social and public health problems. None of them are matters for the criminal law. We must counteract drug use with public information, education, counselling and treatment, not with the big, blunt stick of criminal law.
Mm. Portugal has seen the way and taken it. In 2001, it abolished all criminal penalties for personal drug use. On our continent, the West African Commission on Drugs called for similar action. Not only do criminal laws not work, they also impair proper management of the problem and dissuade people from seeking support and services they need. The prison system is not equipped to offer treatment for drug use, and despite the highly controlled environment, illicit drugs are readily available in prisons. Criminalisation fosters criminal networks and gangs. It pollutes the world of high finance, makes a sham of border controls, and subverts the criminal process and the courts of justice. Behind the misplaced use of criminal laws lies a deep-rooted belief that criminal punishments should be inflicted on those considered deviant. The apartheid state was premised on this notion. South Africa has a history of using criminal law broadly and brutally, not only in minutely enforcing apartheid's misery, but in persecuting sex workers and in hounding sexually and gender-diverse people. However, the voices of reason are growing louder. Portugal has seen the way and taken it. Yep. Okay, that's a re-quote. Following this recommendation, Ghana has become the first African state to rely on alternatives to incarceration and address personal drug use. For long, I have spoken out against criminal punishments being used in the HIV epidemic. There's no doubt that HIV infection is a bad thing, something to be countered and avoided, but we do not help contain or treat it by criminalising people with HIV. Instead, we drive people away from education and treatment, and we undermine proper public health management of social problems that don't belong in the criminal courts. That lesson we embraced in the AIDS epidemic, unlike many African countries, our parliament wisely decided that new criminal remedies targeting people with HIV and AIDS would boomerang. The same applies to drug use. Instead of applying harsh criminal penalties, our country should embrace a supportive, not punitive, approach.
Yeah, it concludes, and this is, of course, by a very senior legal figure who's written this. Criminal laws target already vulnerable groups. The risks of drug use often intersect with and are exacerbated by the risks other vulnerable groups face, like sex workers, homeless people, and those subjected to gender-based violence. The quote, war on drugs disproportionately affects economically marginalised black and coloured people. Mm-hmm. Women who use drugs are subjected to gender-specific discrimination and social exclusion, as in all the stories we've had.
Universally.
They tend to have less access to harm reduction or other services. They experience far higher rates of intimate partner violence and are more vulnerable to contracting sexually transmitted infections. Criminalisation assumes that the vulnerable are enemies of society, and it punishes them for that. Language is potent. When we speak about wars, we invoke the image of the enemy, of the outsider, who's threatening our security and our prosperity. When we slip between criminal and drug user, we do more than create a criminal offence. We criminalise a significant sector of our society, including many in our own circles or families.
Absolutely. I like this guy, hey?
It's really on point, isn't it?
It really is, absolutely, and right up to date, yeah?
Exactly. And coming from South Africa with the...
That's amazing, yeah.
...apartheid history and all that struggle, it's...
It renders everything... It pulls things into perspective for the whole continent, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad we did this piece. The consequences of this rhetoric go damagingly far. People who use drugs are exposed to a systematic process of dehumanisation and discrimination. Additionally, the rhetoric prevents us from engaging with the structural causes of drug use, and it obscures how criminalisation lends support to vicious cycles of poverty that target the most vulnerable and marginalised in society. Too often, the war on drugs is in reality a war on, quote, marginalised communities, end quote.
On us. Yep.
On us, yeah. Drug use is a social and a health issue. It is simply not a criminal justice issue, and is certainly not a national security issue.
I don't know where they pulled that one out of.
Well, it's a nice one.
They're probably sitting on the place it came from.
it's a nice sort of threat to pull out, isn't
Absolutely,
it?
Yep.
There is no health rationale for invoking criminal law sanctions, and he concludes. However, as the abolition movement so often reminds us, abolishing criminal penalties on its own is never enough. What we need is an evidence-based continuum of care and support that prioritises the effective prevention and resolution of drug dependence and protection against stigma. Beyond decriminalisation, intelligent legal regulation for drug use will go a long way to removing the drug-related harm suffered by people who use drugs and the communities that they live in. We are a long way from properly managing the effects of drug use. However, a reassuring international shift is happening, and it points us to better solutions. War talk is increasingly being displaced by social and public health models that focus on the vulnerabilities of people who use drugs rather than any threat, in quotes, that they may pose. The threat instead comes from the misplaced and dangerous use of criminal justice remedies to social problems. It is not too late for us to learn and to do better. And that's from a former Constitutional Court Justice, Edwin Cameron, and he's also the inspecting judge of the Judicial Inspectorate for Correctional Services in South Africa.
Mm.
What an amazing piece.
Well, he's certainly ensured himself a warm welcome from us, hasn't he? And he's encapsulated the last 40 years, Jeffrey, into a 2.5-page article, and it just makes perfect sense. There's a comment by John Cartwright, a brilliant summary of the indisputable evidence that has been accumulated by thorough research and the implementation of alternatives to criminalisation. There will come a tipping point when enough politicians and religious leaders realise that their warlike rhetoric or rhetoric and tough guy posturing is no longer working, and that it's in their interest to change their tune. Also, any thoughtful cop knows that the prohibit or criminalised system of drug control is dysfunctional and misdirected, and will welcome being freed from its grip.
That's actually a good point, isn't it? Because any law enforcement person who thinks about it.
The cops are tired of it, yeah.
It's bad law that they're being forced to somehow...
To enforce, crack down on. Yeah, I mean, the research in the ACT showed, you know, a third of them at least supported the provision of a heroin program in the ACT at the time that the research was done. So that was when it was illegal. There's another comment by Bruce Logan, a well-laid-out argument that again highlights how banning something generally only results in losing any control over it. How many times will we be doomed to repeat this same cycle?
How true.
Yeah, look, they're just two perfect points that goes along with a great article. I'm really pleased to hear that, Jeff.
Yeah, nice to have a story from South Africa.
Nice to have one that makes sense. The only thing that makes me worry is that he's not likely to get the same warm reception from his peers as he is from people like you and me. However, let's get on to another bit of music.
I thought Mother's Little Helper, we haven't had that one for a while.
Let's do that one, absolutely.
Rolling Stones. All right, Mother's Little Helper by the Rolling Stones, and bit of a classic, that one, from the 1960s. We're into the last quarter of an hour of this week's show, and we've actually got another story from Africa, which is on a similar theme to the last one, Marion.
I think we should go on with that one. Drugs, it says, let's admit we were wrong. And this is from the AfricaReport.com of August the 28th. When we were presidents of Nigeria and South Africa, the largest economies on the continent, our administration dreamt of many things. One in particular was to create drug-free societies. We were wrong. We were wrong because we thought prohibition, repression, and prison would protect our children. We allowed harsh penalties for drug-related offences, including the non-violent ones. We legitimised state forces when they arrested and punished many citizens, even when, in retrospect, that was excessive. It didn't work. It didn't work because the prohibition that global superpowers imposed on the world at the end of World War II was a continuation of their political concerns and cultural preferences. It was not a rational and concrete strategy to cope with addiction. Still today, alcohol and tobacco are sold freely and consumed and punished by sophisticated sophisticated marketing, and few people challenge this, although those substances are harmful to people's health. The somewhat artificial distinction between those substances and illegal drugs, such as cannabis, led the world and us as African leaders to many mistakes. Those young people that were thrown into prisons, did we convince them to take a better path? More often than not. The main thing they learnt in prisons is the craft of crime. Absolutely.
Well said.
We say, Jeffrey, University of Crime.
Exactly.
Yeah. They were our relatives. They were our children. Our society has invested much of our scarce money and energy in repressive responses, in pursuit of the illusion of drug-free societies. We need to wake up and abandon this illusion. As of today, we can honestly say that we regret not having questioned the certainties around drug control. We regret even more that these mistakes are being repeated time and again, sometimes in good faith, sometimes simply to extract political dividends out of the misery of people who chose to use drugs. This has to stop.
And once again, it's former presidents speaking, but good on them for
and
coming out.
And two of them.
Yeah, and two of them.
And they said, we're wrong, Jeffrey.
Yeah.
How many men say we're wrong?
Well, that's true. And
you know, never, really. Yeah. And not only that, they're saying we submitted to the bigger powers. And that was what we're saying, don't listen to them. You know, if we could speak directly to them, wouldn't we have said, don't listen to them? They're just trying to win you over, you know.
It's not necessary.
I remember the CIA inviting Gabriel, remember I told you, to a weekend holiday in Britain, 3 days of relaxing and drinking and all with the whole idea of politically embarrassing her and pushing her to make her research look more favourably on the punitive approach to drug supply.
Mm. Okay, it goes on to say, production, trafficking and consumption of legal substances are on the rise. Criminalisation constantly increases the power of criminal organisations by giving them a stronger grip on those whose livelihoods depend on these substances. Demand is there, it is sustainable, and supply will naturally follow. In Africa, prohibition also impacts people who did not use drugs and don't intend to. People who are suffering intense pain in a hospital bed as a consequence of terminal illness or surgery do not receive the grace of pain medicine that is available in rich countries.
That's well, a we really can't get point. It now anyway, well, because we're withdrawing it. But the point is valid, we're withdrawing it. So listen to this, ScoMo.
The international drug control regime has led to deprivation of pain medication on the continent of Africa, mostly because of the constant fear of diversion to the black market. As human beings capable of compassion, we think that depriving people in pain of readily available medication is a disgrace and amounts to cruelty. Well said.
We did those things on Nigeria. Remember the woman in the hospital in the capital of Nigeria who imported it herself.
That's yeah. Right. Some argue that African countries lack the capacity to implement health-centred reforms that include harm reduction and treatment. However, the evidence shows that these services are way more cost-effective than criminalisation in Africa, as on other continents. 50 years of anti-drug propaganda has just impeded debate, but all the war on drugs has achieved is nothing but severely overcrowded prisons, boosted HIV transmission and extrajudicial killings, all at a horrific human and financial cost. There are rays of hope, though. South Africa's judiciary has been led to accept decriminalisation of cannabis for all personal use. Ghana decriminalised too through a bold and inspiring legislative bill. The Seychelles adopted law enforcement diversion. Opioid substitution treatments are functional in Nigeria, Senegal, Kenya, Tanzania, Mauritius and Morocco. Zimbabwe, Malawi and Lesotho legalised cannabis for medical purposes. Whilst these moves are underway, African politicians and communities are struggling to get out of the rigid thinking imposed by the international drug control system. Our countries have long stood by this international drug control regime. We enforced it to comply with international obligations and, so we were told, to fight organised crime. Along the way, we sometimes lost the focus on protecting our people and our children.
Oh, Geoffrey, God, makes my heart pound again, you know. Hooray. Welcome to spring. It's so nice to have some good, positive stories. You know, we're wrong. We see the error of our ways. Let's get into fixing. I actually think we've done some good, positive stories this week. It's nice to hear people coming out of the woodwork and saying, let's go for the good stuff, yeah. And maybe these guys can... I met a judge from Mauritius in the old days. He said, no, we've got no injecting drug users in Mauritius. Don't worry. We don't have to worry about HIV with injecting drug use because we haven't got any. Well, Canberra used to say that too.
Head in the sand.
Yeah. Yep. So yep. Head down, bum up.
No, look, I've always maintained that the first responsibility of any political leader in any country is to look after the well-being of the citizens of that country. And it seems to me that's the position that they're reflecting on, that... You know, in their aim to please and, you know, be seen as meeting their international obligations.
And bring it to the personal, Geoffrey, yeah? Make it your daughter or your son. Think about, you know, your relatives. Bring it down to the small stuff is really the big stuff, just a different genre, if you like, a different, different the size of it, the enormity of it doesn't make it, however small it is, however, is the same. I'm babbling, but it means what I'm saying is the small stuff is the big stuff, just different size. Yeah, so the little issues for your son, your daughter, my son, my daughter, is the same only in bigger stuff. Get rid of the bucks and think about the people. Forget about your house, think of your children. Yeah.
Yeah,
am I making sense to you?
Yeah. I get your point. I just think it's time for people and in positions of power to reflect on the evidence, look at the failures of prohibition. You know, we've given it decades of a solid crack, invested billions of dollars, incarcerated people, had deaths, mayhem, misery.
And it takes the United Nations 20 years to come to any kind of, because they keep on wanting to come to a consensus statement, right? That's why it takes them 20 years to make a decision. 2 years ago, their United Nations drug control program came to the conclusion that it wasn't working. That was 2 years ago. Time everybody else came on board. and said, yep. Okay, doesn't work, fix it.
Yep.
How do we fix it? Start from the little stuff and work up to the big stuff.
Yeah. Look, we talk about evidence-based policy, but on this one, you know, the evidence is in. Prohibition
been in for
is not
ages.
Working.
Yep.
It's not going to work. Why flog a dead horse and why cause yep. more people to die and
yeah.
suffer? It's just, it makes no sense, really.
No,
except
no. And the discrimination that we constantly face day after day is exactly the same as they face in South Africa and in the Philippines. Doesn't change, only the severity changes,
yeah.
really.
Yes. Yeah.
The faces are still the same.
Yep.
The places are different,
yep.
that's all.
And the mindset's the same.
Same face,
it?
Different place.
Yeah. All right, well, that just about sees us out from another show.
Sure do.
I don't think we mentioned Karma's number. We should.
6253-3643. I love saying that because I remember it.
And the office hours are Monday to Friday, 10 till 4.
Every day.
So,
we didn't say anything about people-powered radio either, Jeffrey, although you might have said it while I was...
I did while you were having a cigarette.
Of course you did, which I don't do, have a cigarette, no, never.
Encourage people to consider becoming a supporter.
People-powered radio is a fabulous thing. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. And, Jeffrey, lovely to see you again. I'm glad we did some great stories this week. Really good week. A good week. Nice to see spring come in.
It always lifts the spirits, doesn't it?
Doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I mean, just seeing the sun come out during the day is a nice thing.
It's just so nice. We need to look after our earth and we need to look after our people. And forget the dollars, people. Forget the dollars. Look after the people. The person sitting next to you might be the person that saves your life.
Absolutely. And you can still get in touch with Dave if you want to. Get naloxone.
And please do, 6253-3643. We'll tell you that again because we'll never get tired of saying the number. Get in touch with Karma if you think we can help, because the odds are if we can't help, we know people who can.
Well, exactly. We can refer you on to somebody who
Absolutely.
Can.
Absolutely.
That's what we're there for, and that's what we're about. So thank you very much for listening.
Yep.
If you've missed the show or want to hear it again, you can hear it through 2XX's website, Audio
or
On Demand.
Or the podcast, yep.
Or podcast via the app Podbean. You can listen to any of the shows in the last couple of months. And I have the theme song this week.
Yay! And you had it last week, but you forgot it was in your bag.
Yeah.
Sausage. Never mind. We'll see you next week, people. It's lovely to talk to you again.
Golden Brown. Bye for now.
Bye.